Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do poor people make bad choices? From what they eat to how they raise their families, low-income people are frequently chided for doing what isn't good for them or for failing to take steps that might help them escape poverty in the long term. Trying to juggle school and two low-paying part-time jobs with her responsibilities as a wife and mother, Linda Tirado found herself perpetually short of money, time, and energy, a state that made it a sort of victory just to get through the day. She had heard what so-called experts had to say about helping herself out of poverty, but much of that advice came across as misinformed at best and judgmental at worst. So Tirado sat down and vented her thoughts in a blog post she called Why I Make Terrible Decisions or Poverty Thoughts. The piece struck a nerve and very quickly went viral. It has now been seen and argued over by more than 6 million readers, and Tirado has expanded her thoughts into a full-length work of nonfiction called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. She joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Linda Tirado, welcome to Think.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote this essay. It goes viral overnight. You heard from a huge number of people who identified, and you write, poor people talk about these things, but no one's listening to us.
Yeah, I mean, it actually shocks me that anything that I have said is news to anybody, because it's just such common knowledge and such common discussion. If you're at work and you work in a restaurant, you're talking to your coworkers about, you know, childcare and paying bills and what sort of strategies you have and what your sister's doing to make a little extra cash, things like that. And so to simply have written it down and watch all of these people look at it and say, I never knew that, that's been really eye-opening for me.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenges that you and your family had at the time that you wrote about them in the fall of 2013. How would you describe your life at that point?
You know, it was actually the first time we felt remotely confident about our future kind of being maybe okay at some point. But at the same time, between me and my husband, there were two small children and three jobs and one school schedule. One of my jobs was an hour away through mountains to get to work. And so you'd have 2 hours a day commute there, not to mention, you know, winter weather in the mountains is a little hairy. Mm. So, you know, it's just constant and driving and grinding, and you spend most of your time trying to anticipate your employer's needs and how many hours you might get and what time they might be, and then at the end of the day you sit down, you read the news, and you see somebody essentially calling you lazy because you haven't managed to work your way out, and you're thinking, but I have two jobs, I couldn't. It's not the definition. It's the exact opposite. So that is kind of the life I was leading, where you're just constantly exhausted and you never quite had enough. You know, thank God we were in a position at that point where we mostly frequently had enough. But it was long time getting there from the desperate times.
This idea that people who haven't experienced poverty have, in some cases, that a significant number of poor people simply don't work, that you've already sort of disabused us of that notion. There's also the reality that people who are working in low-wage jobs typically are in no position, like, to make any demands, to say, I'm not going to come in on Wednesday at 6 o'clock in the morning because I, you know, have class, or it makes it harder to sort of just organize one's life, particularly if you have more than just yourself to take care of.
I mean, and the thing is that wouldn't even be considered a demand. Basically, here is the job. We will need you potentially from open to close at any point. We'll be able to call you in. We will switch your schedule around. You'll get sent home early. You'll get kept late. And that is the nature of the work. And it's that way in any service industry, because you're basically running your staff around when customers will be in the door. And what you find is that companies want to keep their payroll low, and they want to keep their labor costs low. So they actually program their schedules down to like 15-minute increments. But then you're also having to kind of react on the ground. If it was really slow last Tuesday, they're going to have low staffing next Tuesday. But if it's really busy this Tuesday, then you're going to have an all-hands call, and basically every employee is going to be called and told you need to be here in about 10 minutes. So it's really nearly impossible to plan, you know, even a day in advance, much less 2 weeks or 2 years. And when you're looking at things like that, sit down and think about how many of those strategies that you would tell somebody that's living kind of paycheck to paycheck and living in these industries, all of the advice that you would give them, how much of it requires knowing how many hours you're going to have at work next week and when they might be. Hmm. How many of them are meetings? How many of them are programs? How many of them are, you know, any number of things that take even the slightest amount of stability to commit to? And when we do try and we can't make it because we've got to work or because childcare fell through or whatever, people look at us and say, oh, well, you just didn't want it hard enough, or see, you can't get even through that. So why should we feel for you? And you're thinking, well, because we, the society that we live in, have created this vast labor market where you've got a third of the country with no real financial cushion. You've got 11 million Americans living under the poverty line, which is only $11,000. You've got, you know, basically a third of the country working in the service industry. And you've got to wonder, at what point do we all have a responsibility to make sure that this vast swath of jobs are jobs that we want our citizens working at? Because that's really the problem that we've got, is we're not thinking about it as we are a society and this is a societal problem. We're thinking, well, this is a market economy and a meritocracy, and if you don't do well enough, then that's your fault. And you know, hey, if we want to roll that way, that's fine too, but you still have the problem of what to do with an entire third of America. And it's impossible that out of that many people, there's any one stereotype that you can apply. There's so many millions. We are, you know, of all colors, we're all heights, we're all different sorts of IQ levels, we're all different sorts of drive and ambition. We all have all of these things on the same scale as everybody else. It is impossible that if I can be a successful author coming directly out of being a night cook at a kitchen, at a diner, that there aren't thousands of other cooks at other kitchens in other diners that could do exactly the same thing. So it's a real waste of potential, and it's a real waste of America.
Do you worry at all that there are people who will hear your story and say, despite the fact that you had this kind of one in a million thing happen based on this thing that you didn't expect to earn you any money in the first place and has allowed you to earn some more money now, do you worry that people are going to point to you and say, well, clearly it's a possibility?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't worry about that, because it is, and it always has been in America. And it's one of the beautiful things. You can be sitting on a street corner and a, you know, Hollywood producer can walk by and just decide you're going to be the next big thing and make it happen. The problem that I have is when people call that the American dream and say, well, you're proof that exists. Because as far as I'm concerned, the American dream was always supposed to be that there would be a job that you could go to, work full time, come home in the evening, have enough money to feed your family and enough time to eat it with them. And anything over that was down to luck and ambition and drive and being in the right time, the right place, and having, you know, all of these other things. But the American dream isn't supposed to be winning the lottery or going viral online or winning American Idol, which is essentially what happened to me. Like, I got struck by lightning. And it's incredible and it's amazing and it's wonderful, but it's no way to run an economic policy. And there's no possible way that, you know, everybody who is working in the service industries, is working in these kind of low-wage professions, can, you know, have the same sort of magic happen. Because if we could, if the economy could afford that many people to win that spectacularly, we probably would have figured out how to do it by now. The problem is that for some people to win spectacularly, a bunch of other people have to not win spectacularly. And that's really kind of the point.
I was really struck by your discussion of people earning the lowest wages in this country. It turns out that minimum wage calculations are significantly skewed by the vast numbers of people who are technically paid above minimum, but that might be like $7.50 an hour instead of the federal minimum of $7.25, which amounts to an extra $10 a week before taxes.
Yeah, it's an extra $1,040 a year before taxes. And, you know, my husband worked for the same restaurant group for 2 years, the same chain. And at the end of that 2 years, where he was one of the best cooks that they had consistently, he had had a 50-cent raise. And that was pretty good, actually, for the restaurant. That's how we knew he liked, or they liked him, is he'd gotten a whole 50 cents after 2 years. And those are the sorts of raises that we get. We get nickels and dimes and maybe quarters if we're lucky. And so when people will look at you and say, well, you just don't seem that invested in getting ahead and advancing, we think, do you know how many raises I would have to get? Mm. you know, you have, and then you run into the trouble of, if they start paying you too much, they can't keep you as many hours because they prioritize the lower paid employees to keep labor costs down. So you kind of run into where we have a career threshold, you know, at $8 or $9 an hour in a lot of cases, where we start to wonder, is that extra $1,000 a year in baseline wage going to make up for however much I might potentially lose in extra hours because he can't afford to have me on the clock?
My guest is author Linda Tirado. We're talking about her new book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. She joins us as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. If you want to be part of this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Back in 2 minutes with Linda Tirado.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative, we're speaking this hour with author Linda Tirado. Her new book is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Linda, certainly the exhaustion of living in poverty is a big takeaway in this book. It also takes a lot of time to do things when you don't have a lot of money that people who have sufficient money don't have to think twice about, even something as simple as paying your bills.
Right. You know, money does not buy happiness. It does buy ease and comfort and convenience. And I think a lot of people take that for granted or don't really think about the effects it has. If you have enough money in your bank that you can just set up your bills on auto pay because you're not counting by dimes and nickels, then you don't ever have to worry about getting a late fee, which can kind of compound your trouble. If you're having to pay your bills every month and you have to stay at work for an extra hour and then the place that you need to pay your bills is closed, then you're late. So there's all these kind of little things where we try very hard to be responsible, but then life can get in the way. It compounds the problem that we had to begin with because we simply, it's a question of cushion. Anybody will tell you that you need a certain amount of startup capital to really make an investment in your life. And if you start with none, you really, really struggle to kind of catch up to where everybody else always seems to have been. You know, we hear a lot about how these kind of low-wage burger flipping jobs are meant for kids. And that's great. But the Census Bureau tells us that it's really only about half of those people in those jobs are really kids. Half of them are over 25, raising families. These are people who would love to be doing something else, but there's nothing else available to them or nothing better available to them. And so they're taking what they can get. And the question we have to keep asking ourselves is, do we want to live in a what we can get economy? Do we want that to be the position that most people find themselves in? Because I would love to see those jobs go back to being what teenagers take over the summer to learn how to deal with customers and manage their time and things like that. But the reality that we're living with is that we have stuck a whole bunch of adults into these teenage lives and then wondered why we're not particularly thrilled, why we're not turning out to vote, why we're not doing this, that, or the other. And the question I keep asking people is, well, well, what would you do in the same circumstances? How would you behave? How would you cope? And the answer is always actually fairly similar to what happens. If you can sit down and just say, well, this is why X or Y or Z, people are actually fairly understanding in most cases.
There's lots of advice out there that if you just took like $5 a week and put it into savings, you'd have start to build up this little cushion. Can you talk about why, even when you've got that $5, it can be hard to set it aside as opposed to spending it on some small, of the minute kind of luxury, if you want to call it luxury, a candy bar or whatever?
Yeah. Well, two things. One is that no matter how much you set aside, something's going to happen. You're going to need that money. I mean, you might need to replace your work pants or your water pump or whatever. But when you're saving at the $5 and $10 range, you can imagine that there will be an emergency expense at some point. Secondly, when it comes to, you know, buying that candy bar instead of saving, how many weeks in a row precisely would you like me to go without even a luxury that costs $3 or $4 before I'm allowed to indulge myself that one time? At what point have I reached the moral limit of austerity where I'm allowed to be human and actually enjoy a thing without racking guilt? At what point have I earned that kind of luxury and that kind of humanity? And if there's a rule, why haven't you told it to me yet? Why do we just sit and just say, just don't ever, never, not once, don't ever do anything human. Never make a mistake. Never make a bad judgment. Never make an actually good judgment that I don't think is good because I don't understand your circumstances. And when we get into that kind of judgmental, you know, talk and behavior, that is where you see the snark in the book. And I say, okay, well, let's take a look at from the outside at the lives of, say, the very wealthy and see how they do. Oh, hey, look, same prescription drug abuse rates, same kind of levels of STD rates, same levels of this, same levels of that. The difference between our luxuries and the luxuries of the wealthy are, one, we uniquely are required to wear hair shirts about our economic status, and two, wealthy people's vices look prettier. It's fine wine out of nice glasses instead of a can of Mickey's with your friends on your front porch. But it's still going to get you just as drunk, man. And let me tell you, there isn't a human in the world that does not occasionally indulge in something like a selfish or we call it an indulgent behavior. And we've talked about those for millennia because they are a human thing. And you cannot take away somebody's humanity, even a tiny piece of it, and then expect them to behave rationally. That's not how humans work. We are allowed to self-medicate. We are allowed to cope in the same way that every other human on earth is. What I don't understand is why we uniquely demonize the poor for doing it. Because to do that, you really have to be saying, like, hey, we know that your life objectively kind of sucks, all right? We get that working at McDonald's and Walmart probably isn't great. What we're going to need you to do is never forget how awful your life is. Like, never not for a second. Can you do that for us? That'd be great. Also, we're going to need your smile to be genuine when you greet your customers. Can't have the fake one. Has to be genuine. Otherwise, they might know that you're not thrilled with your life, that you work in this place. I mean, it's just that sort of question is so ridiculous to me.
I wrote in my notes while I was reading this book that we in this country, in our culture, demand this kind of like humility, self-discipline, self-sacrifice. If you're going to be a poor person that people figure is a good poor person, you have to almost be like a model citizen at the same time.
Oh, yeah. You have to wear your hair shirt properly. Mm-hmm. It's what I call it. But, you know, what's really funny to me is that we do expect people to, you know, sacrifice and never step a foot wrong and always be saving. And the question that I increasingly am hearing is, for what? What is it precisely that we're supposed to be doing? Because if you find yourself, like I did, at 31 years old, working the night shift an hour away from your house flipping pancakes overnight on Black Friday when you work near a Walmart, you know, honey, what do you think is going to happen to you by the time you're 40? How far ahead do you really think you're going to be by the time you're 50, objectively at that point? Sure, you might complain about it online and get a book deal and start doing radio, but the chances are not not that you're thinking that's going to be likely in your future. So what precisely, at what point am I allowed to accept what life is for this many millions of people? How long do I need to pretend to aspire to be an engineer, to be a Wall Street trader, when that clearly isn't in the cards for me? What's wrong with just knowing who I am and being happy with that? Why do I need to be pretending as though I'm going to make some huge step up when I'm probably, you know what, going to be working in restaurants for the rest of my life? That is my likely path to the future. And what's wrong with being accepting of that? When did we start requiring that people want to do more than just work for a living and then have interests outside of work? Why does everybody have to be ambitious? Why does everybody have to display all of these personality traits that we associate with the very successful, as though they're not personality traits, but they are instead, you know, inherent to all humans, because they're not. Everybody's not ambitious. Some people want a really nice garden. That's all they want. Why can we not have a job that would provide that?
Let me ask you this, Linda. As you know, from the people who read your piece, many people supported you. Many people absolutely sort of trolled you online. There are people who say, well, how dare
you? Internet, yes.
Right. for better and for worse, the internet. People say, how dare you have children if you're poor?
Yeah, yeah. You know what my favorite answer to that one is? Let me tell you how I wound up getting children.
We know the mechanics of it, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, kids, let me tell you. No, my husband was recalled to active duty to serve in Iraq in Fallujah, and he went with the Marine Corps. When he came home, we discovered we were pregnant, and we thought to ourselves, you know what the responsible thing to do is? The responsible thing to do is take that GI Bill that you're contractually obligated and go back to school. So we did that. We moved and up and moved to Cincinnati, didn't know anybody, didn't have, you know, any real cushion, but we knew that we were going to be getting the GI Bill, which pays you a living stipend as well as your books and your tuition. Funny thing, the living stipend never showed up. Paperwork complaint. Every week they tell us everything's in order. Every week, no money. Eventually, we both took jobs working, you know, kind of at a burger joint. We'd been in a weekly motel. We showed up. We figured we'd stay a week while we found the apartment. Wound up in the place for, I think, 7 weeks. Found the cheapest apartment we possibly could. And then a summer storm came and flooded everything we'd owned. All the things we'd managed to get together for the baby. Everything destroyed in a flash 2 weeks before I was due with my firstborn. And that is how I found myself living in a weekly motel on WIC when I was heavily pregnant with my first child. It's a funny thing. Not everybody assumes that they're going to be incredibly impoverished by the time they're finished with their pregnancy. But you know what? Even if I had started out at a motel and thought, you know what, I need another kid, I need to complete my family, nobody is allowed to tell me that that decision is wrong. Nobody is allowed to come to tell me what my family feels like before it's complete. That is a decision between me and whoever I am making my family with. That is nobody's business but mine. But if we're going to make it your business, because I was, you know, hey, I was taking public money. Fine. All right. Great. So we know that it takes about $280,000 at this point to raise a child in the middle class from birth through college. So if we're going to start checking people's financials before they're allowed to conceive, I'm going to need a certified statement from everybody's banks before the middle classes go conceiving that they've got that much in the bank so that they can look into the future, that they're 100% positive that they're fit financial parents. And then after that, we can get onto the class behaviors that I actually consider hugely damaging to children that the upper classes, you know, do. Because let me tell you, it doesn't only go one way in society. If you're going to look at an entire class of people and make sweeping ethical judgments about what they are and are not allowed to do, then A, you're walking dangerously close to eugenics, and B, okay, let's have that discussion, but it's not just going to be one group, all right? We're going to talk about everybody's decision-making processes and how many hoops everybody has to jump through. And then, yeah, I will sit down and have that conversation because it's fair, but as far as is, why did I have kids, or how could you have kids when you're poor? Honey, we do it the same way everybody else does. We get drunk one night with our spouses, or, you know, whatever it is. It's the same. We are humans. We procreate. We want children. We do that. We are human. And the fact that I have to say that as though having a low bank account balance and participating in the economy in maybe not quite as a spectacular way as Jamie Dimon would have anything to do with somebody's humanity or their autonomy as an adult or their intellect is just laughable. I have never understood people that can say you should not be able to have children and you should not. Well, what sort of basis are you making that judgment on? And how can you morally defend that and still call yourself a decent human being at the end of the day? I really don't understand it.
Author Linda Tirado is my guest. Her new book is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Linda Tirado about her new book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. I want to talk about this. Linda, you're candid about the fact that you smoke. The reason why you smoke might take some people by surprise.
Yeah, actually, for years and years and years, I didn't have access to medical care. So smoking does a fair few things for you, actually. It is a stimulant. So if you're really, really exhausted, you can smoke and you can keep working for a little while. B, it kind of lights up the pleasure centers of your brain. And we don't get an awful lot of pleasure when you're working in fast food. It's not like you're working in a lovely environment with wonderful people who give you compliments constantly. Like, that's not the nature of the work. So, you know, getting a little pleasure here and there isn't bad. Third, if you're a smoker, you get a break. Like, you can go outside for 5 whole minutes and not have to be in the kitchen. So it's actually a fairly good strategy. My husband picked up smoking for a while when he was in Iraq because he got breaks as a smoker. So if you're on the sort of work where you really need to step away from 5 minutes and can't, you know, it's a handy habit to have. But, you know, it's... A lot of it for me really is just that it was a release for pressure. I don't know. I couldn't tell you chemically what it does for me exactly. But, you know, it would calm me when nothing else would. And it was accessible to me when nothing else was, you know. And the interesting thing is I'm kind of seeing what other people have had all of these years with the healthcare exchanges and, you know, suddenly having access to a doctor and things. And it's amazing what they can do for you at the doctor as far as your quality of life and not being in, you know, kind of intense amounts of pain on a regular basis and things like that. And it's just kind of been shocking to me to kind of see the other side where people aren't smoking or, you know, drinking half a bottle of vodka one night because the toothache isn't going to go away on its own and you don't want to eat that much ibuprofen because you're pretty sure at some point your stomach might actually die. You know, you're talking about people who will take handfuls of ibuprofen just to stave off daily aches and pains, much less, you know, acute ones. And so, yeah, that is a lot of the reasons why I smoked. And was it possibly the healthiest decision for me? No. But I think that neither is eating fast food for every meal of a day, which you do when you work in fast food. And, you know, neither is all of these other things. And so when people have like these real in-depth discussions with me about it, and it really comes down to they just don't understand how I could do something that was so clearly unhealthy. And I keep trying to explain, but you don't understand how much of our lives are that clearly unhealthy. Like, look, dude, if you are living near the poverty line, if you're one of the working poor, you are more likely to die of hypertension hypertension than you are anything else. We die 15 years later than people who have spent most, or earlier, I mean, than people who have spent most of their lives in at least the kind of lower middle class and above. And when you're talking about 15 years already off the edge of your life from preventable diseases, why would you think that suddenly, like, lung cancer is going to be the one that I care about? Like, heart disease, hypertension, osteoporosis, arthritis, all of diabetes, all of these diseases that we disproportionately get, why would I care about this one in particular when this is the one that I actually enjoy? Right? Everything else that's going to kill me earlier is actually a burden that I hate. And if you want to suddenly give me healthy food so I can eat that, I am 100% with you. But really, you're going to take the one vice out of all of those things, and that's going to be the one I should be focusing on? Really? You know, so I can't say I don't get the argument. Is it going to kill you? Absolutely. Yes, kids, smoking will kill you. That said, so will alcohol, so will driving, so will eating fatty foods, potentially broccoli, depending on which day the researchers are at it. And so you're talking to a group of people who don't have access to medical care, in most cases can't live a healthy life. Like, the first thing a doctor is going to tell you is drink a lot of water, exercise, and sleep well, and get less stress. That's like the bare minimum of healthy. And I start laughing and light up another cigarette as I'm walking away, because I don't, that's not even a potential reach, right? Like, stability would have to be gained. And for stability to be gained, I would have to work in an industry where my employers cared in the slightest about my quality of life instead of their quality of, you know, profit level. And since I don't live in that world, you know, it's the same thing as, well, why don't you buy in bulk? Well, honey, you're asking me to have $25 to waste on paper towels up front just because I'm going to get them half off that way. I'm going to buy the double price paper towel roll that only costs me a dollar up front, because a dollar is what I have. Do I know it's more expensive this way? Absolutely. Do I have $25 to blow on bulk paper towels? Not today, honey. You know, so it's all of these things. And it really comes back to, when people say, why do you make terrible decisions? I say, okay, well, here are my options. You find me the good decision that I could objectively make. Oh, I'm sorry, are most of the decisions objectively terrible? Well, then let's not pick at which terrible decisions I'm choosing. Why don't we work on maybe getting me a better option? And then we can lecture at me about how I just have terrible decision-making abilities.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Bridget on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't really have a question, but I just really want to thank the author for writing this book and this perspective. I got a college degree and used to make a lot of money, and then the downturn, and now not so much. And during that time, I became a volunteer with foster children, and so I really relate to. And I would have people ask me this, or say, kind of in an offhand way, well, why did they have kids in the first place? And I agree, you just can't say that. You know, first of all, you don't know you're going to be poor. And second of all, you know, the humanity, that's what we do. And one of my kids, she's now 26, and she just started A&M today, and she was a foster kid, and she has a 5-year-old, and she has worked in fast food and gas stations and all kinds of things to make that possible. And for somebody to tell her, you can't have a child because you're poor, and she's one of the best mothers I know, you know, it's just not fair.
Bridget, thanks for your call. Is there anything, Linda, there that you heard that you want to respond to?
No, I just say, hey, congrats on getting a kid to A&M. That's pretty friggin' awesome. I mean, yeah, it's that basically is what it is you can, anywhere I do radio, and I've done radio worldwide now, and I've done it nationwide and in all sorts of markets. And the one thing I keep hearing is everybody knows people that they say, yeah, no, you can't judge people like that. Everybody knows somebody. It might be, you know, your cousin that doesn't do well, or it might be your favorite cashier, whatever. This is actually a worldwide thing where people will go, yeah, you're right. And so what makes me wonder is why do we have that kind of cultural looking down on, if everywhere we go, we know that we know people? Why are we all still buying into this idea that it comes down to personal worth or personal merit or personal ability or you know, what I like to basically call like being able to be an adult? And why are we not allowing people to be adults if we all know so many adults who happen to be poor?
Don't you think that the judgment sometimes comes from people who are not poor wanting to believe it could never possibly happen to them, that somehow their, you know, work and virtue, they want to believe, shields them from anything terrible happening to them that could leave them in poverty?
Yeah, and I always think to myself, do you know how many times I've been accused of magical thinking in my life? Because, you know, I just figured it was all going to change someday. And here is proof positive that we're not the only ones that do it. Because, look, 2008 happened, and we've got PhDs that are homeless. Like, there was an article that went viral last summer about a lady who, through a series of really acute circumstances, wound up finding herself driving to go get her WIC, her food aid, and I want to say it was a Beamer. And she wrote a piece about what that was like. And we all have heard the stories of people who lost everything and pensions are gone. And, you know, it's great to tell yourself that it could never happen to you, because if you were in this situation, you'd do it differently. You'd save. You would hold out for a better job. You would negotiate better. You would behave carefully, and you would rise up the ranks with a quickness that would astound everybody. And you would be running the company on the strength of your personality and merit on the inside of a year, right? And it's great to tell yourself that. And for those people who can do that, I am so glad you have that much self-confidence. What a privilege and a luxury to be able to feel that way about yourself and legitimately think that nothing could ever stop you. But for the rest of us, honey, there's a bunch of stuff in our path, and we're getting there. We are. It's just, you know, not so much on the superhero status. And I do. I think it's a way to reassure ourselves that it could never happen. When I first saw the article go viral, a lot of the backlash was people who thought that I couldn't be poor because I knew big words and I spoke fairly eloquently, and I'm clearly intelligent, and I'm a good communicator, and I have all of these things going for me. I mean, my God, I'm white. How much luckier do you need to be? Like, all of these things. How could you possibly be poor? You must be making the entire thing up. And I thought to myself, no, see, I actually learned about Rousseau in the kitchen from this crusty old cook in his 60s who used to sing arias when he was sweeping the kitchen at night, all right? That is who we are. We have educations, we just don't have certificates. And without the certificates, nobody will believe us that we're worth anything. And then it's easy for them to look at us and say, well, you're not worth anything because I am, and I'm not in that situation, and therefore I never could be, and therefore we have this static class in our society. And the truth is that downward mobility exists just like upward mobility does.
The new book by author Linda Tirado is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. She joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Linda, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, I've been super happy to have time here. I actually was really excited to talk to Texas. Hello.
Excellent. Well, Texas was happy to hear from you. Thanks to all of you who have listened to the conversation today and participated. We really appreciate you coming along with us on these journeys we take every day from noon to 2. Thanks. Mm-hmm.